It's a real honor for me to get to introduce one of the leading minds, if not the leading mind, in fixed income on Wall Street, Jeffrey Gundlach, the CEO of DoubleLine. I think, you know, the timing today couldn't be better given the headline article in the Wall Street Journal. We spent some time talking about junk bonds joining this everything rally where we're seeing premiums, junk bonds versus treasuries at almost record tight spreads. And so he'll talk a little bit about that, about liquidity versus illiquidity in the market, some of the things that he's seeing. And so excited to have him, excited to have a dear friend of mine, Salita Marcelli, here. We all know and I think love Salita. She leads CIO here in the Americas. So rather than do the formal UBS presentation, what I'd rather do is something a little more personal. I've gotten to know Salita quite well over the last 5 years. We got to work very closely together when I led national sales. And I can't think of a better partner and someone that thinks more about what you do every day with a research hat. So not just looking at the research that she creates and leads, but really thinking about it from a client's perspective, your perspective, what's valuable, and then taking research to really support execution and implementation, to be commercial, to help drive business, to help resonate with clients. And so I can't think of someone better to lead the conversation with Jeffrey Gundlach today than Salita. So I'll welcome both of them on up here right now. Thank you.
All right. So first of all, thank you again, Chris, for your really kind words. And also thank you to the Manhattan Market, as well as our partners at DoubleLine for organizing this event. I'm really excited to be here with you, Jeffrey. I think this conversation, as Chris said, is particularly relevant because all eyes are on rates, inflation, Fed, budget deficit, all the stuff we're going to talk about, but also given our most preferred view on fixed income from the CIO. In fact, I know many of the areas that we like in CIO align really well with what DoubleLine is leaning into, and we're going to get into that in a little bit. We'll also cover a number of topics that are outside of fixed income, because definitely we want to hear your thoughts, Jeffrey, on artificial intelligence, on gold, on election. Right. We'll be here like till tomorrow.
All right.
So there, you know, anyway, lots to cover. So thank you again for joining us.
And well, I'm a UBS client too. So
I hope we're doing well for you.
I've been a UBS client since 1992.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Thank you for staying with us.
So the ups and downs. I never sell anything, so
okay.
It's easy. I'm an easy client.
All right. I want to start with the macro picture. Obviously, your thoughts on the economy. And I think it's important because it's pretty much exceeded almost everyone's expectations.
Yeah. It's because people map past economic cycles into the present. And this is obviously very different because there was $7 trillion of money printed between 2020 and 2022 or 2021, 2022. And that created a massive distortion that makes mapping from the past treacherous. Mm-hmm. And I think we all have started to realize that over time. But the ones that really got it wrong were the monetary economists that use M2. They begin with money supply. And M2 had been growing at a linear type of pattern pre-pandemic. It's just always the same. And then all of a sudden, $7 trillion shows up. And so, like this. And then the money supply dropped a little bit in 2022. Because the money printing stopped. And monetary economists have been trained to respect the fact that historically, when M2 goes negative year over year, there's always a recession. And so my friend Dave Rosenberg, who's on DoubleLine Roundtable Prime every first week of January, he was pounding the table because he's very monetarist oriented for a recession absolutely positively in 2023. And we did an event about a year ago at the Buffalo AKG Art Museum. And he pounded the table as hard as you can pound the table that I'm bloodied, but I'm not wrong. And we're going to be in a recession for sure, like in 6 months. And he's wrong again. And the reason was that M2 went negative year over year, but the quantity was still huge. And to this day, we're above the trend line. If you took the pre-pandemic trend line and then brought up to today, yeah, M2 is getting close, but it's still a little higher. So we're getting closer to the logic that we're running out of steam. And we see that in the consumer as well. The consumer has borrowed a lot of money. Credit card issuance was very large in the couple of years past, and the delinquencies are starting to show up, and the Fed raising interest rates by 500 basis points has pretty much made credit cards really, really difficult to pay. The average credit card rate, I believe, is at 23%. I mean, that should be illegal. I mean, it's just unbelievable that credit card rates are that high. So I think we've started to see signs of slowdown. I don't want to lean too heavily on 1 month of data because it's volatile, but the most recent data is not very good. Retail sales last week were negative 0.3, and that's a nominal number. And since prices are high, you know, that's a pretty weak number because the units sold is weaker than negative 0.3. We see the sentiment numbers are deteriorating. The economic surprise that Bloomberg publishes came out, and it was shockingly low. I mean, it was basically kind of neutral a couple of months ago, and now it's full-on recessionary territory. So I think that a lot of distortions happened from the money printing, and one of the most important is the cumulative inflation rate. Just like the M2 year-over-year wasn't helpful, I think the inflation rate year-over-year, the fact that it's, well, you tell me what the inflation rate is, because there's all different numbers. There's all different time windows. We exclude this. We exclude that. I could argue that the inflation rate presently is 8%, and I could argue that the inflation rate is 2%. And it's amazing how many ways you can slice and dice these numbers. We got the CPI, the core CPI, the super core CPI, the PCE, this PPI, super core. Exclude that. I can do a magic trick and make Jay Powell's life very easy. All you have to do is look at CPI ex shelter. It's 2%. That's it. And it doesn't sound like you're doing that much exclusion, although shelter is a huge piece of people's lives, but it's 2%. But you can also do what the Fed did, which was they've laid and gotten fallen victim to a couple of traps in their press conferences over the past couple of years. The first was super core CPI, CPI excluding food, excluding energy, excluding shelter. For a lot of people, that's almost everything that they spend money on. I think the only thing that's left that's significant might be clothing. That's it. So you're talking about almost nothing for the average person. Super core CPI, they did this at Jackson Hole in 2022 because it looked favorable. You don't hear Supercore CPI anymore. He hasn't talked about it. I don't know. It's probably been a year since he's even mentioned it at a press conference. Maybe that's because Supercore CPI is at 4.8% or 4.9% year over year. And the Supercore PCE, which they prefer because it tends to be lower, is at 3.6. This doesn't sound like 2. And both of them are rising. The CPI supercore is rising very rapidly vertically. Maybe it'll slow down. And the PCE supercore has bottomed out. It's not risen very much or very quickly, but it's rising. So you don't hear about supercore anymore. So they switched November 1st in a fairly shocking move that fueled the everything rally. They switched to talking about not year-over-year numbers. Certainly, they weren't talking about 2 and 3 years. the cumulative number, which is either 20, 30, or 40%, depending on what you're looking at in terms of prices. They started looking at silly types of time windows, 3-month annualized, 6-month annualized, because November 1st, 3-month annualized was 2%, and 6-month annualized was favorable as well. Well, don't look at 3-month annualized now, because it's very high. You know, you're nearly 5% on both PCE and CPI, 3 months annualized. 6 months annualized, one's at 4 and one's at like 3.6 or something. So we got to this market psychology that everything was under control and the narrative became we're in the last mile. Got the last mile to get to 2%. It's at least 2 miles now. And part, the reason for that is large is has a lot to do with energy prices. West Texas Intermediate has gone up by about 15%, was higher, but settled in around 80. And when West Texas Intermediate goes up by 10%, you generally tack on with a lag about 0.4 to CPI. So the oil price move has been significant, and therefore the notion that we would get to 2.5 or so by kind of now has kind of gone out the window.
Okay. So, 2-part question. So first of all, we get it. The traditional indicators of recessions are not holding up. It's not just M2, but also the infamous inverted yield curve.
It's been the longest inverted yield curve in my career. And that's a long time. It's over 40 years.
We haven't seen the recession yet. You talked about consumer sentiment, retail sales, very strong labor has been driver of this economy. So I would love to know what you think about labor going forward from here, and also as it relates to inflation. So what I took from what you said is, it's not what it seems, it is high, but do you think there is secular bias upside from here?
For inflation. Yeah, I do. I think there is. I think the biggest issue is the interest expense on our debt. That's the biggest issue. And I think that it's inflationary. I think we're going to be running looser monetary policy. I think there's an interest in not having low inflation, even as low as 2%. I suspect they don't even want 2% inflation. So I think the inflation rate is likely to go higher. And I think that the response to the next recession is going to be inflationary.
Why is that?
Because the deficit will be so bad that if you zoom out, we have about $210 trillion of unfunded liabilities in this country between unfunded pensions and Medicare and Social Security and all that. And our financial assets are less than that in terms of their aggregate value. And so how are you going to fund these $200+ trillion of liabilities? I don't think you can. And so we have to talk about what we're going to do with that and how we're going to continue with a $2 trillion budget deficit in a positive economy. Mm. You know, if you last year, the budget deficit was greater than nominal GDP in terms of its growth. So there's the old basketball term for the 3-point thing, nothing but net. And I say nothing but debt.
Nothing but that. In that case, how's Treasury auctions absorbing?
Well, it was bad late summer last fall. We had a big rise in interest rates, about 150 basis points, because there was so much debt issued. And, you know, the Fed said, Jay Powell, not the last press conference, one before that, he kind of went off script and kind of ad-libbed. And he said, we've got to get the balance sheet down, because we're going to need to gun it back up in the next recession. So, you know, that's an interesting admission of how we deal with things. But we're going to have to once and for all restructure Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare. We're going to have to do it. And I think everybody knows that. When I started in this business, people realized that the Reagan budget deficit scheme was not sustainable for the long term, but we've been doing it for a long time now. Mm-hmm. And the fear was, or the prediction was, that we would run into trouble 80 years forward, like 2060. And people were like, well, you know, it's my great-grandchildren's problem. I'm not going to worry about it. And then 10 years passed, and it was revised to a 60-year problem. And then it was a 50-year problem. Well, now it's admitted to be less than a 10-year problem.
Do you talked about deficit. Do you think that was unavoidable given the COVID and other crises we went through? Or is it just a byproduct of government mismanagement?
It's mismanagement. When you try to make things always perfect, you have a reduction in frequency of problems. But there's a trade-off between frequency and severity. I call it Gundlach's financial rule of physics. Frequency times severity equals a constant. So when you try to run a hedge fund that does 1% per month, clockwork, never ever deviates, when you finally have the event, you're bankrupt. Remember David Askin? You probably don't, you're too young. Back in 1994, he ran a strategy that was generating 75 basis points per month, and money was pouring in. And I went to clients, this was late 1993, I went to clients of mine, and they were all giving money to David Askin. And I said, this doesn't make any sense. You can't do 75 basis points. He said, 2 years, it's 75 every month. And I said, whenever you're trying to do something that's that controlled, you're going, when the problem comes, it's going to be a huge problem. So the extent to which you try to make everything smooth and perfect, you're building up potential energy of risk. And that's what the government has done. Every time a recession comes, we do the same game plan, but it's always more. It always takes more to get it done. Nobody thought the interest rates would go to zero and stay there for how long? And then when interest rates were at zero, at least we didn't go negative. I give the Fed credit for that. But every recession, it's a much bigger rescue plan. And you get to the point where, well, I remember when there was a hedge fund blow up in 1997. Then we had the lending problem in 2006. And it keeps getting to a different level. And I think the next recession, the crisis is going to be that the Fed is broke. Yeah. The Fed has a negative value on their balance sheet right now. The Fed is bankrupt right now. If you marked the market, it was as bad as negative $1 trillion. So who bails out? Who polices the police? Who bails out the bailers? You have to do a reset.
Are there going to be better days?
Things are going to be so good in about 10 years. But between here and there lies the valley.
Okay. Well, talking about maybe cycles, a fun fact. I know you are a big fan of this book called The Fourth Turning.
The fourth turning. There's many ways of framing that. There's The Fourth Turn, which is Neil Howe's book. He published it in 1996 or 1997 using demography to predict things. He's the leading demographer in America. And he predicted the financial crisis would come in 2006 in that book, based on demography. And it basically frames things as four turnings. When I started in this business, there was a lot of talk about Kondratiev waves, which were 70, 75 years. It's kind of the same. There's a lot of ways of thinking about this. Karl Marx talked about it. Karl Marx was not a communist, by the way. The communists, they took his ideas and twisted them into communism. He was just a historical philosopher. And he observed, and this is the same as the fourth turning, that you get to a place where society sets a system. And the system is a set of rules. You've got the means of production, which is the economy, and then you've got the property relations, which is how the rewards of economics get distributed. And people buy into that because they feel that they're invested in it. It's fair. They're good with it. But the means of production change very, very revolutionary fashion. You've got the steam engine, the telegraph, the radio, the television, the internet, AI, all of these things radically change things. But the property relations are understandably very, very slow to change because the winners in the property relations don't want them to change because they're the winners. They're the multi-hundred billionaires. They're the ones that own the politicians. They don't want to lose power or lose their wealth. So they dig their heels in. They want them to change as slowly as possible. And the tension between the two, they start here where they're totally in sync and it starts to go like this. And then suddenly people say, no more. And you have to reset it. It's kind of like the French Revolution, you know, in 1788, France went off of the gold standard. It just went fiat currency and they got to a debt position that's kind of similar to where ours is today. And there was the Women's March because bread was too expensive. And they marched in a rainstorm to Versailles, 14 miles. They were probably barefoot, be my guess. In this rainstorm, they went to kill the king. They got talked out of it. And instead, they put the king and the queen on a cart, and they carted them to Bastille, and they were in prison. And then the guillotine came out in 1793. You know, that's because they were using this kind of make things fine with fiat currency and the debt, but it doesn't work. You cannot, no one has ever borrowed their way to prosperity. And the way you get to prosperity is you save, you invest, you do not borrow. It's so strange how our society has evolved. I remember getting my first credit card. It was from Sears. I got a Sears credit card, and I was in my early 20s. And I was so proud of myself. I got the seal of approval because I've got a credit card. People don't realize that credit cards are toxic, but that's what's happening. So the four turnings, we're in the fourth turning. It's pretty clear. And what characterizes the fourth turning is complete rejection of norms and established institutions and almost disdain for them. And I think we can all agree that that process is underway. A lot of people want to get rid of the Constitution. I mean, if you look at polls.
They want to get rid of the Fed, too.
I want to get rid of the Fed. People ask me, but I said I would nominate Jim Grant to be the Federal Reserve Chairman because I know he would shut it down. The Fed has 800 PhD economists. They had 700 in 2006. But I guess they figured that wasn't enough because they missed the lending crisis, which was obvious was going to happen. I remember in 2004, I didn't even have a mortgage, but I got a letter from a lending company saying interest only, we were doing interest only mortgages. And look, you can refinance your amortizing mortgage into an interest only mortgage and you'll save this amount of money. And it was a lot. If you don't amortize it. And I thought, oh my golly, home prices are going to go through the roof on this. And indeed they did. And then I realized they were going to collapse. So things take a long time to happen, but you can sort of see it coming.
Is there a major war at the end of the fourth turning?
Not necessarily, although the last two fourth turnings were the Civil War and World War II. So the precedent is not good. And we're at war now. We're always at war. And we can't afford these wars. We're borrowing money to give weapons to Ukraine and to Israel. And giving weapons to Ukraine seems like a very strange thing. I never would have thought that would happen. I mean, when I was 20 years ago, if you said we're going to be giving weapons to Ukraine, I'd say, why? And Ukraine cannot win this war. It's not possible unless you give them nuclear weapons or something. They have no people. 10 million people have left Ukraine. There's like 30 million people in Ukraine. The average age of the Ukraine army is in the 40s. I mean, they don't have anybody. The problem isn't the weapons, is they don't have the people to pull the trigger in Ukraine. And yet we're backing them. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing all these things? Why are we borrowing all this money? Why do we run a $2 trillion deficit every year? Does anybody know? I think I know. It's because it's a circular financing scheme. You give money to big established entities that get government contracts. They mark them up 1,000%, and there's a slush fund that can then keep those politicians in power. And I think people are getting to be aware of this. So we run a deficit on purpose, which is really a sick thing to do. I think when we finally restructure everything, we won't be able to run a deficit. People won't trust us to run a deficit. Then it's a good thing. We'll actually run on a sane economic basis. But we haven't been doing that really for my entire career.
I'm going to tell you, I have not read the book, but I came across a hour-long podcast on this book about 6 years ago, maybe. And I was actually running fixed income at a competitor place. And with my fixed income optimism, I got taken away by this concept. And it's quite scary.
When you're 12 years old, you think everything's always going to be the same. And it actually was for a while when I was 12. Things were really stable in the 60s and 70s. I mean, there was war, Vietnam, there were protests very similar to what we have today. There was a building burned down in 1968 at Berkeley. But those were sort of legitimate protests. I mean, who wants to be 18 years old? You're not allowed to vote until you're 21 back then. You're 18 years old and you're being forced through a draft to go to Vietnam to kill or be killed. I mean, what are we doing there? Well, that's very similar to what we're doing in Ukraine. You notice that during the entire Vietnam War, the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, never moved. The whole war. The line never moved. So it was just a stalemate the entire time. That's Ukraine. It's like, and it was the same logic. It was called the domino theory. That if we don't back South Vietnam, then Poland's next. That's Ukraine.
So I don't know if there is any smooth way to transition from these multi-decade-long cycles into current rates and Fed outlook, but maybe I'll try.
Okay.
So
sorry.
No, I'll try. Let's see. Investors have been sitting on record levels of cash in money markets. After what I heard from you, I feel like they should stay in cash.
I think you should be liquid. That's primarily, I think you should be liquid. I'm actually not a fan of T-bill and chill. You can get 5.3 on a six-month bill. You've been able to for a while. But I worry that could turn into a three.
Yeah, but do you think this is a good time now, your views on fixed income, to move from cash and to put it to work, at least in the near term?
I do. I think you have to be very, very careful about it. I think you want to own higher tier credit. I don't mean AAA or something. I mean double B, triple B, maybe some single B. But you need to, I think you want to stay in liquid things. Mm-hmm. Because I think the spreads are very tight, as we talked about earlier, that Wall Street Journal article. The spreads are tight, but there's no, doesn't seem like there's a disaster at the doorstep exactly. We do own credit. We own more treasuries now than we've owned in the past several years. It's not a majority of the portfolio. It's more like, it depends on the strategy, but it's more like 30-40%. It's actually less than you find in an index fund, but it's more than we typically own. And we are very diversified in credit, but we like 3-year to 5-year.
Okay.
You're off of an inverted curve, so your base rate is relatively high. The problem with like investment grade corporate bonds is they're priced off of the 10-year treasury. And the 10-year treasury doesn't yield all that much. So you put on the 90 basis point spread on top of the 10-year treasury, you got the same yield as the six-month bill. So I don't know about that one. But if you go off of the 3 year or the 5 year, you're off about a 4.7 base rate, and you can tack on in low risk investments. Like we love BB bank loans. We've loved them for a couple of years, if not 3 years, because they're just not that risky and they price off of SOFR.
Yeah, but are you worried about the current pricing? Because the pricing has gone up quite a bit.
Yeah, it's when you buy credit, I was talking about this last October because credit was at low prices.
Yeah.
There's a huge difference between buying credit at the 2001 year-end levels, where you're buying credit at a price of 105 on junk bonds, and buying credit after the big interest rate rise of 500 basis points and a spread widening back in October, buying them at a price of 60. When you buy credit at 105, defaults are fatal because you don't get all your money back. When you buy them at 60, you can have 40% of your portfolio default with a recovery rate of zero, and you get all your money back. So the problem with credit is what we call wonky word, is sort of credit convexity. When you buy them at par or higher, you have no upside. Junk bonds are callable. Bank loans can be refinanced. You can't go up. You can only go down. That sounds like a bad trade, right? No risk, no reward, nothing but risk. But you're still at discounts on some parts of the credit market. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the bank loan market is no longer at a discount. It's basically the double Bs are actually above par. So it's less attractive than it used to be. But if you go into places that have some of that cushion because they're still at discounts because of fear, if you can underwrite it properly, you have something that's pretty attractive. We own AAA CLOs. Mm-hmm. We're selling them incrementally because they're now at about par and a quarter. They were at 90 when we started buying them. So the 90 is free. It's free because you're not going to have any defaults on AAA CLOs. You go into certain parts of the commercial mortgage-backed securities market are pretty attractive. Stay away from urban office because that's going to be a long road. I'll give you an anecdote. We have a building down the street from us in Los Angeles, 777 Grand Avenue. And there was a CMBS transaction that funded the purchase of the building. And it was underwritten at $490 million, the loan. And based on the $490 million a few years back, they issued $310 million of debt. Some of it was senior and some of it was mezzanine. The mezzanine bond was wiped out completely because the building was sold at under $200 million. So they floated $310 million of debt. It was deemed to be AAA. It had a 60 LTV, and the mezzanine was wiped out. Interestingly, that mezzanine position was entirely owned by a daily NAV fund that was sold as a core, lowest possible risk commercial real estate fund. And they were wiped out. And I was talking to my CMBS team and I said, wow, I mean, how long did it take? He said, well, they started the sale process six months ago. And it basically, you know, it became obvious it was going to be wiped out. And I said, so at what point was it obvious that the mez was worth zero? And he said, you know, probably 3 months ago or more. And I said, can you please tell me where that security was marked 4 months ago, 3 months ago, 2 months ago in this daily NAV fund? I haven't gotten the answer yet, but I'll bet you anything it wasn't at zero. Yeah. So this stuff is going to start being the headlines. So you want to stay away from that sort of thing, but you can buy very strong collateral securities in parts of the CMBS market, warehouses, data centers, and you can get yields of 7% with almost no risk.
Sounds like we're pretty much aligned because in our CIO portfolios, we've been quite bullish on agency mortgage-backed securities. But
they've done great.
They've done great. AAA, CMBS.
We have an ETF that is nothing but AAA CMBS. Actually, there is one security that's... Shudder, double A. But we don't rely on rating agencies. We have about the largest CMBS team in the industry, and we're very careful about it. Last October, that fund had a 1 year duration and a yield of 8, and there will not be a default. There will not be a default. Now it's 6.5, unfortunately,
yeah,
because the spreads are down.
And even though BBB CMBS did really well, up 11, more than 11%, that's the part where we want to be selective.
I want to be very careful, because when the everything rally started November 1st with the Fed pivot, and it really started a couple of weeks earlier, I guess Goldman Sachs got the communication as usual, and the CMBS team came to me in December, and they said the weirdest thing has happened. Securities we had priced at 60 are up 15 points in the past 2 weeks. 15 points, that's 25% in the past 2 weeks. And he said, but the thing is, the fundamentals are worse than they were in October. The delinquencies are worse, and the securities are up 25%. Well, they've rallied from there too. They've rallied further. So there is a lot of complacency in the market. The stock market is valued very similar to where it was at year end 2021. It's more sensible today than the valuation 2021, because you knew with certainty at the end of 2021, if you were paying attention, you knew with certainty that interest rates were going to go up.
Yeah. I want to leave fixed income, but I have a very quick question, final fixed income question. You always say Fed follows a 2-year rate.
I can show you the chart.
What is 2-year telling you today?
2-year treasury is exactly in line with the dot plot. So there's risk, because there is no difference of opinion. The 2-year treasury is basically at 480 or so. And I think the Fed says they're going to cut rates. Well, they say now 3 times. I think that's going to change at the next meeting. It's going to be very interesting to see what the dot plot, because the June meeting, they've got to come up with the SEP. And what are they going to say for unemployment? What are they going to say? It's going to be, because the Fed had the luxury of kind of everybody buying into their narrative the past couple of meetings. I was really surprised the last meeting, how the Fed basically said there is no chance we're going to raise interest rates like this year. Like we're not even talking about it. And of course the market loved that. So that gave further fuel to the rally that was going on.
Equities, you mentioned valuations seem
really high.
Really high.
Really high.
What do you think the drivers from here onward going to be
for the equity market? I really think it's interest rates are going to matter. The equity market loves the way the Fed has been talking for the past 6 months, understandably, The Fed seems to be in the frequency severity problem. they want things to be unchanged forever, and that's not going to happen. So I think I also think you mentioned labor. I think the labor market is weaker than is characterized. Jim Bianco at Bianco Research, he's a friend of mine. He's on my roundtable every January as well. He points out, he's been so bold as to say he thinks the weekly unemployment claims are rigged, because they were 210 to 212,000. Like I don't know how many weeks, it was a lot of weeks in a row. We finally got one at 230, but then it came back down. I just wonder about it. There are different surveys. There's the establishment survey is the one that comes out the first Friday of the month, and it gets all the play. And interestingly, the revisions never get any attention. And the revisions have been pretty significantly negative on average. Lately, they've been less bad, but they don't really focus on the household survey, which actually is when you're at the turning point of the economy, the household survey tends to be more accurate. The household survey is not good. In the 3 months, like late last year, January, May was February 2, the establishment survey was really strong, and it helped the risk asset rally continue. But the household survey was negative all 3 of those months. And that's really a tell. The other thing is there's state data. States do unemployment. reporting as well. Nobody even talks about this one. And I haven't looked at it in the past maybe 2 months. But a couple of months ago, it was interesting that of the 51 reporting states, DC counts as one, so there's 51 reporting districts, there were only 5 or 6 that said unemployment was not rising. 45 of them said unemployment is going up. And what were the states that said unemployment is not going up? Wyoming, North Dakota. These are not big states. Now, granted, there was Pennsylvania in there and Texas was in there. But what said unemployment was going up included California, New York, Illinois, New Jersey. I mean, we're talking about big population states. Now, people have argued that the state data is flawed and all this stuff, but I find it an interesting contrast. So the unemployment rate has gone up from its low, but not very much. And I think that the Fed is willing to let the unemployment rate go above 4 before they cut. I don't think they're going to let it go to 4.3. They'll cut at around 4.3, I think. And historically, when the unemployment rate goes up by more than 0.5%, you always have gotten a recession. Doesn't mean it has to happen this time, but it is up by about 0.5% from its low. So if it rises another 0.3 or so, I think we're in a recession. So we'll see what happens. I'm not positioned full on for a recession. I've actually reduced the duration of our funds from, we were at the maximum back in basically in October, mm-hmm. where for the first time in the history of Double Line, we actually had an index duration in, say, our total return bond fund. We were at a duration of two at the end of 2021, and the index was at basically 6.25. And index is still about 6.2. We're at 5.9. Not very different. If I was positioned for a recession, I would be longer in duration. And I would sell. If I really thought a recession was, that we were in one, I would be more aggressively selling credit. But we have been selling credit. Gradualistically, the liquidity of the bond market is not what it used to be at all. There used to be a lot of activity in the bond market where you could do swaps, you know, sell bond A for bond B, pick up 5 basis points, reverse it the next week, because there was so much trading, there's so much balance sheet at the major broker dealers. But that's gone because of the regulations. So the liquidity in the bond market is periodic at this point. There are moments when you can't get a bid for certain assets. So you have to acknowledge that that's a fact, and that when you do get this everything rally, which we've had, it's probably sensible to be spending your time systematically looking for bids. And we've been surprised at the things that we've sold in the past month or so, at how strong the bids are. I mean, there is a very high demand for what at times are unsaleable securities. There's been high demand, which is a further sign of complacency. So I think we've been taking advantage of that and selling things that we sort of can't believe that people are willing to pay what they're paying at this point for some of the things that had no bid 6 months ago.
Two hot topics. AI, I think you likened artificial intelligence to the tech bubble. I must admit,
AI is not a thing. It's just higher computing power. That's all it is.
Is it like computer. The dot-com bubble? Because we are pushing back to
CIO. I sort of think so, but you never. Let's tell you how this works. I saw the bubble in 1999 with all of the dot-com stuff, and I turned maximum negative on the NASDAQ September 30th of 1999. It went up 80% the 3 months after it. 80%. However, if you had shorted the NASDAQ September 3rd of 1999, you were able to buy it back at half that level within a year. So the thing about fads and trends and everything in the investment business is it goes on longer than you think it should. The most important thing in investing, there's two important things. First is it takes longer than you think every time. And the other is you're going to be wrong. From time to time, you're going to be wrong. Most people are wrong more than 50% of the time. People that are good in the investment business are wrong about 40% of the time. I've been wrong 30% of the time in my career. That's a lot because I've been at it over 40 years. So I've been wrong more than 12 years. Thank God they weren't 12 in a row. Right? So it goes longer than you think. But you have to know you're going to be wrong. And that means don't bet the ranch on one thing. Because if you're wrong and you bet the ranch, you're going to go bankrupt. You're not going to make it. You make it 40 years plus in the investment business by not betting the ranch. The journalists are funny. They say, you were positive on the long bond. How come you didn't? And it went up 50%. Why didn't you own anything but the long bond? Because if I acted that way, I'd be out of business. I structure portfolios saying, if I'm wrong, make it not fatal. Make it so that you live to play another day. And that's kind of how you make it in the investment business. You don't bet the ranch. People that bet the ranch go bankrupt.
Okay. What's hotter than AI, and maybe kind of plays into the hedging conversation to some extent, is gold. And questions coming from a gold bug.
I own gold.
To you. Yeah. What do you think after this fierce rally and its role in portfolios?
I in our roundtable prime, which we do first week of January, my recommendation on real assets was gold. I didn't think it would go up 20% in 5 months, but it's pretty high. I have owned gold for a long time. I didn't sell it in 2011, probably should have, but I wouldn't sell it now either. If you're a gold interested person, I would not make my full, if I have a zero today, I would not put my full allocation in today. I would be dollar cost averaging because it's high. But commodities broadly look like they're in a bull market to me. They're rallying. It was just kind of a surprise. They were in a bear market for the past 2 years. They were below their 200-day moving average, the Bloomberg Commodity Index, almost all the time since 2022, summer. And they've come up above it, and they're going. It's a pretty strong rally going on in commodities, which troubles me relative to the inflation outlook. And it makes me wonder what's going on. I think it's driven by copper and gold, primarily. Oil, to some extent, not recently, but earlier in the year. But I think commodities are broadly interesting at this point in time.
I'm listening to your advice. I always say my best investment was getting married, because 90% of the wedding gifts came in the form of physical gold.
When was that?
July 2007.
Nice.
And I haven't sold since.
No. I like real assets.
Right before the
I like real assets a lot. I own a timber ranch in Alabama. First of all, it was almost free. It's unbelievable how cheap it is. And but it's real, you know? It's 1,200 acres. It's completely self-sufficient. Water, power, everything. Protein source, everything. Right? I like that a lot. I like farmland a lot. Things that produce things. But I like real assets broadly. Gold's part of that. I think, personally, and I have a very strange... I'm not like a median person in my finances, but I have probably 80% of my net worth in real assets, 20% in financial assets. And financial assets, you know, I own, it's a very bad hedge. It's actually a Texas hedge, but I own double line funds. Texas hedge is when you own two things that are guaranteed to move in lockstep with each other. Right? My biggest asset is my ownership of double line.
Yeah.
And yet I'm investing in double line funds. It's a terrible hedge. It's a Texas hedge. But I believe in the management.
That's wonderful. Last one, elections. Are you preparing for that in portfolios? What do you think about it, first of all? I'm not going to ask you to pick the winner, obviously.
It's going to be wild. It's already wild. Well, what's going on is it's unbelievable. I don't think Biden's going to run. I think he's going to drop out. I do. I just don't think he can make it. I think if he runs, he's going to lose. And I think he's going to lose if he runs. And I think they all know it. And that kind of means you're stuck with Trump. I don't know if RFK Jr. has a snowball's chance in hell. I actually would vote for him, I think, over Trump. But he's got some weird ideas. But I like the fact that he's anti-war. I like that a lot. I can't stand the fact that the United States thinks that it's the world's policeman when we don't have any money.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.